prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror films, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Lance.
And I'm Erica.
And before we dive into this episode's film, Erica, can you give us an update on the Indiegogo
campaign? Yes. When this episode comes out, there are going to be about 4 or 5 days left in the campaign. Mm-hmm. As of this recording, I'm at about 180%-ish.
Yes.
So yeah, anybody, if you're holding out to the last minute, now's the time.
Yes.
Not saying they won't be available later, but you get your name in the project supporter page, possibly some other goodies if I'm able to grab them before the books come in. But yeah, again, thanks to everyone so far who has pitched in. This is the last you'll hear about me until I get the books, and then I'll just be like,
we'll be gushing over it like that. We'll do 4 episodes on the book.
It's like Dead Kids, you know, Dead Kids Q4.
Yeah, everybody guarantee your copy. You guys need to head there if you haven't already and back the book, The Sweetest Taboo Boo.
It is, yeah, Boo Boo thinks it's named after her. It's cute.
I love that post. Okay, let's get into the episode's film.
Yes.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, it's my pick, the Spanish romantic horror, La Llamada, or The Sweet Sound of Death from 1965. It follows Pablo and Dominique, a young couple who are madly in love with each other and are planning their wedding. They live in Spain together. Pablo is Spanish and Dominique is French. And before she takes a plane to visit her family in France, they spend the day together doing what young lovers do, sleeping late, going out to dinner, and heading to a local cemetery to just hang out,
mm-hmm.
which is hot. Dominique is fascinated with death. And although Pablo is a little more reluctant about it all, they make a promise to each other at the cemetery that should one of them die before the other, they will visit the other from the afterlife to prepare them for the hereafter. It's all perfect timing because Dominique's plane goes down on its way to France, and Dominique is one of the many who are killed in the crash. Pablo is distraught. He can't believe it. And although Dominique is included on the list of the dead, he receives a phone call from her and is over the moon that the love of his life is still alive. He sees her a few times, and as things seem a bit odd, he teams up with his professor to help explain. He's a medical student, by the way.
Oh, okay. I was like,
they don't really talk much about
doctor.
It.
Okay.
but he teams up with his professor to help explain, like, what the hell's going on. The professor can't see Dominique while Pablo can, so something is definitely off. So they travel to Dominique's home in Brittany, France, where Pablo meets her creepy family and tries to get Dominique to head back to Spain with him. And there's obviously more to how it all ends, and as usual, we'll be talking about spoilers.
Yeah.
As of this recording, The Sweet Sound of Death has 209 views on Letterboxd. It's streaming on Amazon Prime and YouTube, both of which are English dubs. There's also a weirdly edited down version on Dailymotion, which I recommend people to stay away from.
Hmm.
I'll talk about like what it leaves out because I watched that one real quick too.
Huh, okay.
It still works, but it changes the movie completely.
Huh.
So yeah, Prime and YouTube if you haven't seen it. So The Sweet Sound of Death is directed by Javier Seto, or Xavier Seto, which he used for a lot of his films, including this one. And there really isn't a lot I can find on Seto.
Yeah, I mean, he died pretty young.
He died in his early 40s.
After this came out, so...
Yeah, he has... He doesn't have a whole lot of credits. He did direct 16 films in the last 10 years of his life, so he was really going hard. I'm sure he was planning to add some more like horror and like crime thrillers, which... A lot of the stuff in reviews I've read, a lot of people seem to think was a strong suit. But he mainly directed like romantic dramas and comedies, not well-known films that I'm familiar with or heard of. Long play, The Castilian, a movie called Bread, Love, and Andalusia. But other than The Sweet Sound of Death, his only other horror film was one of his last films. I think he passed away in 1969, and Macabre or Shadow of Death was released in 1969, starring Larry Ward. For all the geeks out there, he provided Greedo's voice in Star Wars.
Oh my God.
But he plays two roles as twin brothers in Shadow of Death. And it's a funny one.
Twins.
It's like a ton of work from characters who they kind of make a plan to try and make one of the twins go insane to take his wealth. And it's completely unbelievable situations and very involved planning on their part. I was like, why don't you just kill them?
Yeah, I had a really hard time. They didn't distinguish the twins well enough.
No, they were like, I could understand why one twin would fool the other because they were just exactly the same.
Yeah, like one like had like coiffed his hair a little bit differently.
Right.
And that was the only difference. Like when I first met you and Cody, I was like, okay, this is easy. I can tell them apart right away. But like these two, they did nothing. I know it's the same person, but put in a little effort, give one of them glasses, fucking something. You know?
Yeah, it was hard to keep track of.
And so I was like, wait, is this one or is it that one? I could, Ridley, hi, honey. Sorry, folks, my cat gonna keep chiming in here.
Which works because there's a black cat in this movie.
Honorary guest host. In honor of the black cat in this film. So
she has a lot to say about it.
Yeah. I liked Shadow of Death. Like I thought it was fun, but I was very frustrated with how this director chose to portray the twins and really didn't do a good job distinguishing the two.
I agree. I mean, I think the thing I love about movies with twins is you can get away with so much when you have twin characters. Mm-hmm. Like for my review, I put Twins Make the Impossible Possible. 'Cause in this situation, it's like, okay, I guess if there's actual twins that look exactly fucking alike,
yeah,
this could work. But yeah, I still need to get Cody on as like a guest and pick something that's twin related.
Yeah.
Like Blood Link with Michael Moriarty. Have you seen that?
I haven't.
It's wild.
I was holding on to that one because I thought you were going to pick it because of twins. And yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it'll be this year.
Okay.
But anyways, back to the movie. No more twin talk. Twin Talk, that's a good podcast. Anyway,
there you go.
So the director, Javier Seto, he co-wrote The Sweet Sound of Death with Paulino Rodrigo Diaz. Seto co-wrote most of the films he directed, and actually Rodrigo Diaz co-wrote most of Seto's films with him. But Diaz didn't really have many other writing credits other than a few of Seto's films and some others. And as I mentioned, there's English dubs on Prime and on YouTube. And the English dialogue was written by John Hart, who he's written English dialogue for a lot of great Spanish and Italian films, like Sergio Corbucci's The Great Silence, Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill. But still, you should always opt for the original language with subtitles if you can find it whenever and wherever. All the versions I can find of this movie are English dubs, but he does a good job with the English dialogue, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Cinematography. It's handled by Francisco Sanchez, or he's credited as Frank Sanchez. And although Sweet Sound of Death is like obviously low budget, you can tell from the low cast, the minimal cast, and the locations, his photography really makes this movie work. There's not a whole lot of artificial lighting that I could tell. When it's dark in a room, it's very fucking dark in a room. When you're outside, it feels like you're outside with them, kind of just watching these people walk around in love. He shot a lot of good movies that we've talked about. Most recently, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, which was my double feature pick for A Dragonfly for Each Corpse. He did a few Leon Klimovsky films like I Hate My Body and Devil's Possessed. But his more popular work is probably shooting the last two films of the Blind Dead series.
Oh, yeah.
So he's a great cinematographer for what he's working with. And then last in the crew that I'm going to talk about is Gregory Garcia Segura. He's the composer. He did the original score for Sweet Sound of Death. And he had an amazing career working on hundreds of films, scoring Lindsay's A Quiet Place to Kill, the recently released Santos versus Dr. Death. He did the Icebox Murders, just hundreds of other Spanish films. And his score in here, I think, is fantastic.
I really enjoyed this one.
Very jazzy, which I've become very accustomed. I used to always say, like, totally out of place, totally inappropriate. But now I realize, you know what, it works every time for me. So guitar-driven jazz in this has this great recurring melody that the kid with the harmonica starts pulling out a couple times that we'll talk about. But I think it's strongest when it becomes incredibly eerie and tense, specifically when the Pablo character goes to Dominique's family's house. And it's like this really feeling, this creepy feeling of dread that reminded me of The Shining, just kind of this droning, orchestrated, almost synth sounds, but yeah. I don't think there's synth in it. But yeah, great, great original score by Segura. And the cast, yeah, I mentioned it's small. It's a minimal cast. Basically, there's a cast of three people until you hit the hour mark and you're introduced to three new characters from Dominique's family. But it's basically Pablo, Dominique, and the professor. And first is Pablo, played by Emilio Gutierrez Caba, who was credited as Emil Cape in this movie. Mm-hmm. He's a Spanish actor still working today, hundreds of film and television credits.
He's got an Instagram that's active.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even look him up.
Yeah.
What does he post? Just like his new work?
His new work, like movie stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed like one of the direct, I think his latest release was directed by Eugenio, what's his name? Eugenio Mara, I think, who did Grand Piano with Elijah Wood.
Okay, and, yeah.
But yeah, some of like a few films worth noting for this podcast is his roles in Bergenzelli's In the Folds of the Flesh.
Oh, yes.
And the Spanish horror Stigma from 1980.
AKA Bad Lip Bleeding.
Bad Lip Bleeding. Yeah, that's a fun one. And Caba basically, he plays a brother of the lead character who can basically wish or will people to die just by thinking about it.
Yeah.
And when he does, his bottom lip bleeds. Yes. Kind of like a stigmata type thing.
Yeah.
Has like a Patrick vibe to it.
A little. Yeah, totally. It does. I like that one. It was an odd one. And it has, I can't remember his name. The kid in Tenebrae, like the helper.
Yeah, the main kid. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. He's got a good look. Like I'm surprised he doesn't have a whole lot of credits, but he seems like he would be in more films.
Yeah. I watched a more recent one with Caba in it called Neruda. From 2016, where he plays, Caba plays Pablo Picasso in it. So he's only in a couple scenes in it, but I thought it was interesting. And I read Neruda in college and I loved it and I didn't really know that much about it. So that set me down a little like wormhole learning more about Neruda before I actually jumped in and watched the film. Cause it's more about him hiding from the government. Cause he was not only a poet, but a senator. I'm going way off topic.
No,
I'm not talking about the movie. But anyway,
I'm going to watch this.
It was a good movie. It's on Canopy. So
yeah, it looks like it's on Tubi too from 2016.
Yes.
But yeah, the young Emilio Caba, I think he has a great look. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I had just picked Libido with the young Giancarlo Giannini. Mm-hmm. And I feel like he almost has a look like that. Maybe it's the black and white and he's always wearing a suit.
A little bit.
He gave me some young Paul McCartney vibes, too.
Okay, you want to know what John called him? And yes. This is going to blow your mind.
Okay.
He says, this guy looks like if Peter Bark was normal.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they're both very, very good looking people. I would have a hard time choosing.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Fuck, kill, marry. What's the game?
Mary,
fuck,
kill.
So who's the third guy? Giancarlo Giannini. Peter Bark, Giancarlo Giannini, and Emilio Caba.
Ooh. I would fuck Giancarlo, Mary, Caba. What does that leave? Kill?
Kill.
I don't want to kill Peter Bark.
Yeah.
That feels bad.
That's cold.
I know. Oh.
But I feel like you're heading in the right track. I'd probably want to marry Giancarlo Giannini so he can build me gadgets and shit.
Smart.
And then I'll go ahead and fuck him either. Cap his brains out. I don't care. He looks like Paul McCartney from early Beatles. Like, he's got that poppy look. Anyway, yeah, we're going all over the place this episode. I love it.
I'll wait till we get into like the movie because I went down some rabbit holes.
Okay. I love it. Okay, we're almost there. Let's talk about Dominique's character, played by Dianic. Is that how you say it?
I think it's Dianic.
Dianic?
Yeah.
Zurakowska. She's a Belgian actress. And she's worked on, she's been into quite a bit of like horror genre films, particularly Spanish horrors, like The Killers, One of 13, Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, another Klimovsky jam, The Vampire's Night Orgy, which is great, The Hanging Woman, and Cauldron of Blood, starring Boris Karloff. Did you watch that one?
I did, yeah. I had a lot of fun going on my side, you know, side watch research with her, because not only like Cauldron of Blood, that one's on Tubi, I think, mm-hmm. where I watched it. That poster is an all-timer. I love it. And the movie is messy. I think I already messaged Matt to let him know there's a dummy drop in that one.
Nice.
But it's Boris Karloff as a blind sculptor. And this is during his brief stint of cashing paychecks in Spanish movies. I gave it 2.5 with a heart. Like it's a hot mess, but it's fun and it's worth watching for what it is. I watched a couple of Westerns that she's in.
Yeah.
Navajo Joe, which is Corbucci. Yeah. And I had never seen it before. And I didn't even know Burt Reynolds was in it.
Really?
And I was like, holy shit, Burt Reynolds in brown face.
yeah, terrible.
That one was really good. And then I just watched actually another one this morning.
One by One?
Mm-hmm. She plays Dolly and it doesn't show up until sort of like the very end of it. But what's interesting about that one is as soon as they show up to the house where Dolly lives, where Dianique's character lives, I looked at it and I was like, is that the house from Once Upon a Time in the West? And so, of course, I have to pull John in because, you know, he's got Rain Man brain.
Right.
And he said he wasn't sure, but like when they showed a different angle, he was like, well, that's definitely where they had the shootout in the big gun down with Thomas Milan. So I think they're the same locations. I forgot to look it up. Somebody can confirm in that or whatever. And then there's another one I didn't watch because it didn't have English subs or a dub. And it was called Two Magazine Girls. And a lot of the reviews called it the Spanish Showgirls.
Huh.
But I watched some clips of it and it's similar in plot only. It's a musical comedy. It's not like trashy. Mm. It's basically like two women like trying to make it in a big stripped down musical type thing. So, but nothing is Showgirls. So
right.
that was a bit exaggerated in your reviews, letterboxed users.
Yeah, I watched one of her films called The Hanging Woman from 1973, and she's great in it. She hams it up with Paul Naschy, who's also in it, and mm-hmm. Stelvio Rossi. But it's it's like a basic family's out to get inheritance, so they're messing around with each other trying to get to it. But she has just a really great look, like really compelling face.
She's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this movie works so well. The Sweet Sound of Death, because of the cast, because it isn't something I will talk about a little later, but it's not gory. It's not straight up horror. It's basically just watching these performances. It would be a boring movie if you didn't have two powerful lead characters.
Right.
And Pablo and Dominique are really great characters that are portrayed by the actors. Okay. Let me fly through the rest of this catch, cause I want to hear your thoughts on this. Carlos Limos plays the professor. He's credited as Carl Limos in this, and he has quite a bit of Spanish television credits. He does play another professor in The Ghost Galleon, but not a whole lot of other film credits. He definitely has a professor look.
He does, yeah.
And then quickly, we have Dominique's family who pop up in the final act of the film. Tota Alba plays Dominique's mother. And she had some small roles in some cool Spanish horrors like Paul Naschy's Inquisition, Strange Love of the Vampires, and an early episode we did, The Possessed.
Oh, Demon Laird. Witch Child, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was Mother Gautieri or something like that, yeah.
Paco Moran plays Dominique's older brother. He has a few credits, including The Blancheville Monster, which was included in the Gothic Fantastico set from Arrow recently with the third eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Sunda Sanders, who didn't have any other credits, but she plays Dominique's aunt. And that's pretty much the cast. There is a caretaker, which we'll talk about later, but I didn't go down that rabbit hole.
We got some rabbit holes to go down right after this promo from our network.
You You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so I picked this film for a few reasons. It's still February. Love is in the air, or love is not in the air for many. And this starts off with, like, there's a very young love. It's a blossoming relationship between Pablo and Dominique. It's very adorable. I got some Day Six and Little Fish vibes with how cute they are together.
Same. Yeah. When I first started watching it, I was actually really surprised how similarly it starts off to The Demon's Baby. And I was like, oh, Lance is loving this. I was a little bit like, okay, movie, let's get going. And so I can see that now, how other people see that in The Demon's Baby, where they're like, can we get to, like,
right,
what's making this movie, like, the reason I'm watching it kind
right.
of thing.
So. There are no horror elements. I mean, there's some dialogue that gets a little dark, specifically from Dominique, because she is infatuated with death, we right. find very early on. But the setup, you know me, I do love watching this innocent, very natural progression of any relationship. But when it's like yeah. young love, I'm like, because they're, you know, it starts off very uplifting. The score hits it on point. Like I said, the score gets way more tense and dread-filled as the movie goes on. But they're, you know, they start off with like, what do you want to do today? I don't know. You decide. You know, I'm playing hands at dinner and
naming kids,
yeah. planning their wedding, you know, yeah. just making kissing noises at the end of every phone call. Yeah. Just a blast to watch. And it's perfect setup for what does the twists that do come up.
It does. Yeah. Like it's one of those things where in hindsight or like at the end of it, I'm like, okay, well, the questions that the movie is asking of your level of devotion makes sense now with how much time is spent on the relationship.
Exactly. And it's a quick short runtime movie, but they do spend a lot of time on their love.
Yeah.
Which I like. So another reason I picked this, oh, and I guess another, to go back to the whole love thing, if any of our listeners have a partner or a friend who does not like horror movies, I think this would be something fun to watch with them.
Yeah.
Because there's no gore. It's very tame, but it makes you kind of think these creepy thoughts. Like it's thought provoking in kind of a chilling way.
Yeah.
And another reason I picked it is the weather. We're at the tail end of fucking winter, and The Sweet Sound of Death, it makes you feel the chilly air. Like when they're outside, the characters are all bundled up. Even when they're inside, you could see their breath indoors, which yeah. I just love the feel of this film.
But yeah, like you mentioned, it does have some elements in that first part of it that do get a little bit dark. And, you know, there were definitely some parts that made me perk up, like especially when they go to the cemetery.
Yes.
And Dominique starts talking about some things that she's into. And she said, I'm attracted to death. I always thought it the state of perfection for all men.
Yes.
And of course, in my brain, like I immediately perked up and I was like, oh, hello, are we going into necrophilia territory here? And, you know, then they get into the pact, like you mentioned in the summary, and her saying, you know, tell me you'll love me after death. And I was like, do you mean that literally
yeah.
or figuratively? Where are we going with this movie?
Yes. I love how confident she is in like her beliefs, you know, thinking that death is kind and it's like the ultimate peace. But when she starts wanting to make this pact, I'm like, this is like deeply romantic, but it teeters on the edge of like creepy infatuation. And like, it's not what normal people would discuss in an early relationship before they get married.
You don't have those. Yeah. That's a little bit off. I thought this was going to be a vampire movie. Because when she was doing the pact and she grabbed a piece of earth and like the whole, like, oh, love me after death. And I was like, is she a vampire? not abiding rules vampire because we're out in the daylight kind of thing.
Right.
Or does she know she's going to become a vampire? What's happening here? But it didn't go that direction. So.
Yeah. So when she was talking about it, like I said, I felt this confidence from her, and like you kind of gather, or I felt like she knew something was up. Something was about to happen. And because like I said, in the summary, they make this pact. She leaves the next day and she's killed.
Yeah.
So it sets up everything that she had talked about in the cemetery immediately. And they kept in the script, again, this is the English dub, but they kept bringing up Brittany, France. Mm-hmm. So I was like, what is the association? Like, that is a very specific location. So I looked it up, mm-hmm. and there is like all these Breton traditions surrounding Brittany, France, which I think it became obvious why Seto and Diaz used this location. So in Breton tradition, there was no significant separation between the living and the dead. Both dwelt in discrete worlds that were in perpetual relation with one another. The souls of the dead surrounded the living, wandering the skies and sunken paths of the land as animals, like black dogs, cats, horses, or hares. Even mice and butterflies were said to be hosts of the souls of the dead, mm-hmm. which I think is when, you know, I'm skipping ahead, but when Jacques, her dead brother, was like, I'm going to turn this light off and you'll see your true form in the living world.
Right.
And it's a black cat.
Yeah.
And then also it says in Breton tradition that it isn't simply a matter of being comfortable with the subject of death, but for many, a very literal familiarity with death himself, for it could be your own uncle or neighbor, which is also kind of hinted on with Dominique's family here. They're kind of coaxing in Pablo and stuff, and they're almost like death guiding him to stay with, you know, in eternity in the afterworld. But the role of the Grim Reaper is passed on to either the last person interred in the local cemetery, or for some, that last person to die who is a member of each town's parish, as the close of a calendar year takes the role of death. So all these traditions I found out that are specific to like the lower part of Brittany, France. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, so they probably were aware of this old school tradition. Apparently a lot of it went away in the 40s during like the World War and stuff.
Well, not all of it, because fun fact, in France, posthumous marriage or necrogamy is legal.
You can marry a dead person.
You can marry a dead person. It's legal in France with approval from civil servants and the family of the deceased. Now, this is mostly so that wives of military servicemen, if they got knocked up and like they got killed or whatever, like they could not have a child out of wedlock. So it's not like it's a common practice or anything. And it's not like, oh, let's prop up the corpse and take photos together.
Or maybe like an inheritance type of thing where you can take over someone's wealth
or something. Yeah, along those lines. So, I mean, it's more of a, there's no corpse involved with it. I wishful thinking on my part when I went down this rabbit hole. But it's basically like a woman will stand next to a picture of her deceased fiance while a ceremony takes place. And then the mayor conducting the ceremony will read the presidential decree instead of the deceased man's marriage vows.
Strange.
So there is an actual ceremony for it.
And this is only in France?
This is in France. I'm sure there are some other countries where it's legal for that reason.
Yeah.
But do you want me to go on my whole like huge other side thing here? Because this led me into...
One of your favorite subjects.
Well, no, not necrophilia.
Okay.
But... ghost marriage in China is a thing. So a ghost marriage traditionally is the marriage of two deceased people. And it's usually because of the agreement between the families, because both of the people, the deceased, were unmarried at the time and they didn't want their family member to be alone in the afterlife. So then they would perform a marriage ceremony for the families to basically say, okay, your son and my daughter will have a ghost wedding for them.
Ghost weddings are two deceased people not living with the dead.
No, I'm not done yet.
Okay.
They can be. So,
yes.
And this is from an article in the BBC. So believers in the custom, this was practiced for, you know, some 3,000 years, say it ensures the unmarried dead are not alone in the afterlife. Originally, the weddings were strictly for the dead. and the ritual would be conducted by the living to wed the two single dead people. But in recent times, some have involved one living person being married to someone who is deceased. And so a lot of this and the resurgence of the practice has come mainly due to the one child policy and there being way more men than women. Like I think something like 20 million was the number. So many of them are unable to find a wife during their lifetime, or maybe they don't have a chance because they die young or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the main reason for the resurgence. So a lot of times the family of the man will, if they can, try to find a wife who needs money to marry their son, even though he's deceased.
Okay.
And it's not even just in those cases, though. Like, it's actually led to some murders. So one man in 2016, Northwest China, he was charged with murdering two women with mental disabilities because he wanted to sell their corpses to be used in these so-called ghost weddings and make money off of it. There's a whole thing about it. Yeah. So the wedding ceremony itself would typically involve the funeral plaque of the bride and the groom at the banquet. The most important part of it, though, apparently, is if both parties are deceased, is digging up the bones of the bride and putting them inside the groom's grave. So they are also physically together as part of the ceremony.
Makes sense.
So it's not just China. It's also Taiwan. It is its own country, folks. So if an unmarried woman passes away, her family may place red packets or envelopes with cash, a lock of hair, and a fingernail out in the open and wait for a man to come by and pick them up. The first man to pick up the packet is chosen as the groom, and it's believed to be bad luck if he refuses to marry the ghost bride. So guys, don't pick up red envelopes with cash if you're in Taiwan.
Man, if you see cash hanging out though, how can you not? But if you
luck.
See if you see an envelope with like a fucking fingernail in it, just
yeah.
Kick it in the gutter.
Yeah. So of course, like the next step I go in down this rabbit hole is, well, there's obviously got to be movies about this, right?
Yeah.
Not really like anything in our wheelhouse. Like there's some more recent ones. There was some Netflix movie that came out a few years ago that was based on a book that a woman wrote because of a story about her uncle being part of a ghost marriage or something like that. Interesting.
Was he selected or did he pick up?
Selected, I believe.
Wow.
And so, I mean, there are a few movies on this subject from China, but they all seem to be more recent. And I was like, so there's no like Shaw Brothers, like category three ghost marriage movie.
Jeez, that would be perfect.
I know, right?
Because it does seem like some sort of made up Shaw Brothers myth or something.
Yeah.
Like,
but it's, I mean, the whole tradition of it is, you know, and there's some documentaries that I watched on it, some pretty short ones on YouTube. Some are like, you know, 15 minutes, some are 40 minutes. And, you know, the way that the people who actually do the ceremonies describe it, it's actually kind of sweet in a way. I was like, people didn't find love in their lifetime and now we're giving them a chance in the afterlife. That's kind of cute. It's like the, you know, like a Beetlejuice ceremony kind of, you know?
I mean, I think you can present the macabre in any like cheerful, sweet manner.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think so too. Ridley agrees.
She agrees. Yeah, no, there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, this movie, like I said, it's thought provoking. Like it opens up like that stuff about the Brittany, the Breton tradition. There's a couple of interesting articles. If any listeners want to go down the rabbit hole, just Google Lower Brittany, the Land of the Dead or Death Lore of Brittany. Yeah. And then obviously look up ghost marriages.
Yeah. I mean, this one really came up because, you know, Adam's review on Letterboxd, hi Adam, was, you know, he had mentioned in his, like, it really got me thinking. I wasn't expecting that out of this movie.
Right.
And yeah, like what it got me thinking was like, you know, obviously I go to necrophilia first. I'm like, can you marry a corpse? And then I find out about ghost marriages and this whole thing. And so but obviously the bigger, more sort of important and philosophical question is that devotion, like how much if you love someone, are you willing to give up your own life to be with them and
exactly.
for eternity? Like, I don't want to fucking be with anybody that long. I mean, granted, a lot of that is like me bringing in my own baggage, but like this idea of like a death pact and like soul connections, you know, in my head, I'm like, just let it die.
But yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we might have talked about like in past episodes, probably the John Hucker the passing episode, right? Like, if you believe in an afterlife, or I think I specifically asked about reincarnation and stuff.
Putting your consciousness into another person. I was like, hell no, I'm out.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, if there is some sort of afterlife where you can live eternally with, you know, it may not even be like a partner, but like your best friend or anything, a pet. I mean, I don't know. But
aww, boo-boo.
To be locked in, and the way that the Sweet Sound of Death portrays it is Pablo, when he went to go meet Dominique's family, he could be with her for eternity in that location is what it sounded like.
Yeah.
And that sounds miserable because they were each portraying like regular real life. They still had emotions. They still had reactions. They still had their own mentality and memory. So there's going to be fights. You know, somebody's not going to do the fucking laundry. Somebody's going to leave the door open or something, and it gets really cold in the house. Like, that does not sound good to live in eternity. You know, there's got to be a reset, right? There's got to be a reset button.
You got to have. I can't even imagine wanting to be with anyone for eternity. Wanting to live forever. I mean, shit, I couldn't even stay married for 5 years. So, I mean, who am I to talk? But like,
I'm locked in. I've been with Sarah for decades, and I feel good about it. But
you should.
I don't want to spend eternity with her. I know we're gonna die.
It's nice to have, like, I don't want to say looking forward to the end, but it's the idea of eternity is so much more terrifying to me than the thought of like actually dying.
Yes.
I don't want to live forever. I don't want to have I hope I don't have a fucking soul.
I mean,
I'm pretty sure I don't.
I could consider living forever on like this plane, on this earth, on this physical plane, is like some weird fucking spirit. If I could just be by myself and like fuck with people and do what I want, and I don't know. I mean,
I need an end. I absolutely need an end. I don't. I mean,
you could probably take naps, like in the.
Love naps, but I just want to take an eternal nap and never wake up from it someday when my time comes. It's getting dark, but I can't even imagine sticking around forever, even just to fuck with people, as much as I hate people. I couldn't get any satisfaction because I'm like, I don't want to see how shitty this world is going to turn out to be. Like the planet is destroying itself right now. There's so many reasons I don't want to stick around.
And the question is kind of tiptoed around in the movie itself, especially when the professor is talking to Pablo and he realizes, I can't see Dominique. You know, they go to her burial. Pablo sees Dominique standing there. She's not really there. The professor can't see her. So he starts asking him questions. You're obviously in love with Dominique. And he's like, oh yeah, she's my being. She's my whole world. The professor tells Pablo that sometimes it's not wise to love too much, to be obsessed to the point where one does not exist. And, you know, Pablo seems infatuated with this idea of eternal love.
Yeah, he does seem infatuated with eternal love, but I don't think and I think that's important because when we get to the end, you see that he doesn't realize what that actually means and like the consequences of feeling that way.
Right. Right, right. Because he's basically asking her to tell him, like, love any other man but me. That's what he tells her. He's like, I can't do this. Like, okay, if you want to have internal love, go for it. If you want to be stuck in this place for eternity, I want to go back to Spain, basically. Love any other man except me, I think is the word, is like the quote he uses.
Yeah.
And that's why I know we're skipping ahead, but the ending. Okay, so there is a twist, and I know I'd mentioned this too. There's a Daily Motion. It's like 76 minutes long on Daily Motion, and they cut out the whole scene where Pablo is told by Jacques, her brother, that he died at the dinner table.
How do you cut that out?
They cut that whole section out.
What the fuck?
And so there's no mention of him being dead. There's no mention of him being revealed as a black cat. It kind of works, but obviously that's one of the main twists in the whole fucking movie.
Right.
Because at the end of the movie, the professor goes back to Dominique's tomb, like her family tomb, and sees all three relatives and then sees Dominique's grave. And Pablo's there crying over her. So he's not dead, in my opinion. He is not. The way I see it is, this is what I think. The twists get a little weird. He's told he's dead. He died that night, and that's why he's stuck in the house, and he's with Dominique forever. But the professor comes and kind of saves him, in right. other words. And he's like, you're okay, you're safe in this place. Pablo kind of wanders out of the room and goes to the tomb. The professor sees him, and he's kind of crying over her dead body at the end. Pablo is crying over Dominique. And to me, it sounds... I feel like when they had that weird argument where he's like, basically like, release me. Don't love another man. I can't do this. I feel like she did. And the whole purpose of the movie is dealing with grief. So he finally accepts that she's dead at the end, and he's kind of mourning her at that point, the last shot. She does not agree.
Ridley, you gotta go now. I'm sorry. I know. Oh, gosh. You're fine. Go ahead. I'll jump. I know.
So, yeah, the end, at first I thought he was dead. I was like, did he kill himself so he actually could be with her, because he realized, I actually do want to spend eternity with her. But then it was like, no, he is dead, because he was told he was dead at the dinner table, but then they didn't show anything. And, you know, you go, you know, rewatching it, watching the dinner scene in question where, you know, he had been told this is when you died. There's no like little, I don't want to call it an M. Night, like clue to look at and see like, oh, yeah, like he could have died right there. There's nothing like that. It's just
there, like, well, there is some weird, like they're talking very, very cryptic. It's a very odd scene. It's one of my favorite scenes when he finally goes to the house. But yeah, there's a lot of thunder crashing and the lights are kind of going out. And then it just immediately cuts to him looking out the window.
Yeah.
Which I thought like, okay, maybe that's when he died. But
yeah, I guess I just...
I don't think he was dead at the end, but I don't know. You think he's dead?
I think he's
with
dead.
Her corpse.
Yeah. I think he did. I don't know. Fuck. Now I'm going back and changing my, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I am too.
Like, yeah. I wouldn't argue with anyone either way. If they said like, yeah, I think he died at the dinner table because he saw himself as the cat. Right.
Right.
Or were they just playing, or are they just ghosts, like just fucking with him? They're like lances. They're like ghosts who are fucking with the, yeah, the living and are like, oh, didn't you know that you're actually dead? Oh, look in the mirror. What do you see?
Yeah. I mean, I guess another question too, are all cats like just wandering dead souls, just asking for belly rubs and to be fed? Like,
I mean, that tracks with Ridley.
But no, yeah, the more I thought about it, because again, this is a thinker. I felt like, because at the professor does see him at the end. He's talking to him. He's communicating with him. And Pablo gets up and just walks out of the room while the professor is taking care of him. And I feel like the concentration, to me, when I kind of quickly rewatched it a second time, the whole concentration is dealing with grief and the death of a loved one or any you know, thing that, any traumatic event, where you kind of have to just go through this mourning period. And I feel like he got to that point at the end.
Yeah.
And that Dominique released him because her love was so true that when he said, I can't do this, love any other man, but you know, myself. And she just has like this frozen kind of almost brokenhearted stare, won't even look at him. And then that's kind of like their last conversation. I feel like at that point,
I think you're giving her too much credit, because that would require her to, not be selfish. And women are terrible people, mm-hmm, who, if she's like, no, you and I said that we were going to be together forever. You promised your soul to me. We did the dirt pack in the cemetery. No, I am not letting you go. Women are stubborn as fuck. I don't think she let him go.
But true love prevails over all.
Fuck, no, it doesn't. Stop.
Yeah, I don't know. I am very interested to hear what people think and what their interpretation of this is. I think most people will think, and it makes sense, that he's dead. And at the end, he's dead. But there's clues, like when Dominique is dead in the beginning, mm-hmm, there's some clues, like they do meet up and she like has a Superman 2 moment where she like pulls the kids a kid throws this wooden airplane into the fire, and she just reaches in and gets it and doesn't get burned. And Pablo's like, huh, well, that's weird. And then there's a lot of conversations between Dominique and Pablo, and then between Dominique's family and Pablo, where they just talk about time. And she says, like, time doesn't mean a thing. Like, it doesn't mean a thing. It's foolish.
Right.
The mother says, like, time is an invention of foolish men, and basically because they live in eternity. So there are these hints that Dominique, early on in the movie, is clearly dead. Only Pablo can see her. The family starts talking about supernatural world. I mean, that is my favorite scene, where Pablo goes to the family's house. And he walks into the room, and the brothers, Jacques, is leading him in, and the camera pans up. It's like this huge kind of cathedral type room.
Mm-hmm.
And you go down and you see the rest of the family members, and they're sitting there like in the dark, looking at each other like they both know the sinister secret that we're all that's going to be revealed to all of us. Then they at the dinner table, there's like no alcohol. They start talking to a guy like named Marius, or
yeah, whoever their butler or whoever was, they were like he was supposed to be serving them. And yeah, I love that dinner scene.
So yeah, you know that they're dead, you know that Dominique's dead, but yeah, I feel like Pablo is on this cusp of, he's in the dead realm, but he remains alive. I don't know, I'm gonna stick with that.
Do you think the kid with the harmonica is dead?
So the kid with the harmonica, because he pops up on three separate occasions.
He's like messenger.
I felt like he's like Karen, the ferryman, like who takes the dead across the river Styx, you know, like to the dead to the underworld.
Yeah, he's some kind of connection between the living and the dead.
Yeah.
Because he can see both, like he can deliver the message. He's Lydia Dietz or whatever. He can see dead people kind of thing, you know. You know, he himself is strange and unusual, but
yeah, he's just a cool little character that pops up. And then the caretaker who has a small little section too, or a small little segment. He's really funny too.
Yeah.
When he's talking to the professor.
My favorite scene is actually when Pablo is driving and he has a vision / feeling about the plane crash. Because I thought, I was like, because my sound actually does randomly cut out on my old TV because I was watching it in the bedroom, and I was like, oh shit, did my sound go out? And then I was like, wait, did he go deaf? What's happening? And
right.
It was really cool. Like rewatching it, I appreciated it a lot more. I was like, oh, that's what happened. And
yeah.
He has this flash when the plane actually does crash. And again, it's going back to his connection with Dominique. You know, this is post, you know, cemetery dirt pact. And so there is some kind of connection that he has to her spiritually already, and he feels it when she actually does die.
Yeah, I love the way that scene's presented. It's like all his hearing is completely gone, but his like senses are all heightened, and he has this crazy premonition that it's true. Yeah, that's a great scene. You got anything else you want to talk about?
I think the only other thing is, you know, just sort of the balance that this movie has. You know, we already kind of talked about how the first half is mostly focused on the love story, and then the second half gets more into this, I don't know, death mystery type of movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I also did like the balance of settings in this. You have a lot of external, not, you know, we're in the park, or like urban settings, you know, on the streets or in an apartment. But then you also have the cemetery and this sort of gothic manner that the family lives in. So I like the mixture of those two, because I would call this a gothic horror movie, even though typically we usually see a more consistent gothic setting throughout an entire film.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still feel comfortable calling it a gothic film.
Yeah. And then like, just to add on to that too, like I think the pacing's really quick, but the locations keep you fully invested, but it does go back to Zurakowska's and Emilio Caba's performances. Cause especially as Pablo, he gives you this journey of, you know, he's fully committed to life and love. He's very happy, it's just this uplifting feeling. And then he experiences this traumatic event. It's this intense sadness and fear, which turns into intrigue, him trying to kind of solve what's going on. And then, in my opinion, this ultimate grief at the end. So, yeah, I mean, I just love the way this movie's paced. Would you recommend it to people, Erica?
Yeah, I love this movie. Great pick. Went down a lot of weird rabbit holes, and I was fully invested the whole time watching it because I was, at first I was like, vampire movie? No, not vampires, but ghosts. But wait, is he dead? Wait, is she dead? Yeah. It's rare that a movie gets me to, to think and ask questions. And I got that out of this film. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And it's the same. It's not as cheesy, but it's kind of like a Spanish Twilight Zone episode where it kind of, it tries to throw so much at you and it's kind of open for interpretation and it is thought provoking. So yeah, I had a lot of fun with this. I think a lot of people will.
Yeah.
What would be your double feature pick for it?
Double feature pick. There's a lot of options you could go. You could go with the Death Pact double feature, not necessarily a love story, but Black Pit of Dr. M has one.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
I think I saw a few reviews that referenced some other films about, questioning, the soul and if you're dead and what's happening and coming back, spending time in cemeteries, things like that. So like Carnival of Souls, mm-hmm. Soul Survivor, Roland's Iron Rose, things like that.
Yeah. When I saw Adam mention that, I was like, I thought the same thing. Like,
yeah.
Fucking cemeteries. I love it.
I don't think I could do an Iron Rose double feature though. Cause I mean, good Lord, I would put people to sleep.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's a test of endurance right there. I'm going to go with one that is one of my favorite movies of all time. I have the one sheet for it. I think it's got one of the greatest one sheets ever. And that's Gary Sherman's Dead and Buried from 1981.
Hell yeah.
This is about, tourists passing through the town of Potter's Bluff. They're getting murdered only to be discovered alive and living a normal life soon after. It's seaside horror. I love seaside horror. It's got some great gore. It's campy, but it is still gloomy in its way. I think a lot of that has to do with the seaside horror of it. And, it's basically that whole dead coming back to life question mark kind of thing, even though this is very different. It's not like a ghost thing like it is in Sweet Sound of Death. But I would play this one second. It would be the B pick at midnight.
That's a good one.
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah. So Soul Survivor, Carnival of Souls, those would obviously pair well. And I was initially going to pick another Spanish horror. I watched Murder Mansion recently.
Oh, okay.
Murder Mansion.
Yeah.
It has a creepy cemetery playing a small role in the story. And you think people are dead when they're not when they're actually not.
Yeah.
Some similarities to Sweet Sound of Death. It could work well, but I wanted to stick with the almost doomed to love theme. And I'm going with Night Tide from 1961, directed by the great Curtis Harrington.
Mm-hmm.
This is also Dennis Hopper's first lead
film,
role.
Yeah.
So Hopper plays a young sailor who he meets this beautiful young woman who's posing as a mermaid in the sideshow circus. They end up falling in love and you can't really tell if she's some sort of like real siren that set out to kill him and all the men she meets, or if their love is like really meant to be. It has the same feeling that there's something off, like with this young blossoming relationship. It's like this lingering mystery that you think you might have figured out, but there are a lot of surprises that pop up. It's all very sad. Like with Pablo and the Sweet Sound of Death, you're almost rooting for the guy to just walk away from this because it feels like cursed love that will not end well.
Yeah.
It's shot in black and white. I think it'll just look good together. I would go, I don't know. I'd probably go any order, really.
Yeah.
I'd probably end it with Night Tide.
Okay.
No, I'd end it with Sweet Sound of Death. So people can really
talk about that.
Yeah.
Ending.
And be like, what the fuck? Is he dead or is he alive? But Night Tide's like on every streaming services. If you haven't seen it, Tubi, Prime, Shudder.
Yeah.
I highly recommend that movie.
Yeah. It's got a great indicator release. I think it's out of print, or at least the special edition one is, but yeah.
Cool. What's next on the calendar?
All right, next on the calendar. So the next movie, but not the next episode, and I'll talk about that after this. Next movie, my next pick is Fear No Evil. And this is 1969, not the 1981 Teenage Lucifer movie. Fear No Evil 1969 is a TV movie about a psychiatrist specializing in the occult. And that's Dr. David Sorrell, played by Louis Jordan. Most well-known from Swamp Thing and apparently some James Bond movie. So he's called upon to help a woman whose fiance has recently died and his soul has possessed a mirror. This also stars Linda Day George in it, who we all know from Pieces.
Mm-hmm. Bastard! Bastard!
This has a Kino Blu-ray release. It's actually a double feature Blu-ray release along with Ritual of Evil, which is a sort of sequel to this film. It basically carries over the character of Dr. David Sorrell into it. Unfortunately, this one is not streaming anywhere, not even on YouTube or anything like that. But if you're not looking to pick this up or would prefer to wait until Kino has another big sale, and that'll be any day at the rate they go with their sales, or like every other month they have one.
Yeah.
There's still going to be plenty of reasons to listen, because we're probably going to be talking a lot about TV movies in general with our guest. I think this is actually the first U.S. TV movie that we've covered. We might have done something that was a TV movie internationally.
I can't think of a U.S. TV movie we picked.
Okay, so first U.S. TV movie, bringing in the big guns for this one, since we're talking about that. Amanda Reyes is going to be joining us for this episode.
Yeah.
She is the author and editor of the book, Are You in the House Alone? A TV Movie Compendium, 1964 to 1999. She's also the host of the Made for TV Mayhem podcast and a frequent guest on the slasher podcast, The Hysteria Continues. She is a frequent commentary and essay contributor for boutique Blu-ray releases, not just for TV movies and TV shows, but also for movies like Last House on the Left that Arrow put out and the upcoming behemoth of a release from Second Sight, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. She's got a new commentary track on that.
Nice.
So, but before that, though, we have 3 Wednesdays in March, Lance, which means bonus episode.
Bonus episode.
So we're going to be doing our third round of Blu-ray wish list. That's going to be our next episode coming out March 1st. And this is where we and our guest each pick 5 movies we'd like to see get a Blu-ray release, including which distribution label we think should put it out and what special features we'd like to see. This episode, our guest is going to be Brian Sauer from the Just a Disc YouTube channel and podcast, as well as the co-host of the Pure Cinema podcast. And we'll also have some bonus picks from some other guests, Ryan Verrill of The Disconnected, as well as Celeste La Cabra, both of whom have YouTube channels where they discuss physical media releases. So it's going to be a jam-packed episode full of Blu-ray wish lists.
This is a big, fat, juicy bonus episode.
It's a big one.
Yeah, I love it.
Yes.
Perfect.
So that will be the first episode of March. Then we will have Fear No Evil 1969 following that in mid-March with Amanda Reyes.
Nice.
If you're not already, you can follow this podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Instagram, Letterboxd, and Twitter at Hex Massacre.
I'm on Instagram and Letterboxd at L Scheibe.
Thanks everyone for listening. Hope we didn't make you have too much of an existential crisis with your soulmate, folks.
I feel like there's a lot of research that we're dumping on y'all. Y'all go down those rabbit holes like we did with this one. It's a good time.
But don't think too hard about where you and your soulmate are gonna end up.
Yeah, have a happy Valentine's Day,
everybody. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. Bye.
Death is just a door, Blake said at first. It's just another room we enter. It's a threshold that hurts. Birth is just a chorus. Death is just a verse in the great song of spring that the mockingbirds sing. We come and we go, a weeping and a wailing, our heads in the hands of the nurse. Well, put your head on my shoulder, baby, tell me where it hurts. You say you lost your one and only, could it get any worse? I said death is just a door, you'll be reunited on the other side.
Birth is just a chorus, death is just a verse, in the great song of spring that the mockingbirds sing. We come and we go, a weeping and a wailing, our heads in the hands of the nurse. Well, put your head on my shoulder, baby, tell me where it hurts. You say you lost your one and only, could it possibly get any worse? Oh, death is just a door, you'll be reunited on the other side. Yeah, death is just a door, you'll be reunited on the other side. Oh, yeah, death is just a door, you'll be reunited by and by.
Hey, it's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about a thousand cats would look like?
It's called Night of a Thousand Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!